This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to another issue of Women's Health Magazine. I'm Susie Bartlett. Sit back and enjoy, and let's get started. We are on the food section. This is called Soil Solve. A growing food movement empowers farmers to leverage natural resources to produce better, healthier, and more sustainable foods. Groundbreaking? Not exactly. Game-changing? You bet. In the search for the healthiest food options, a few factors typically take center stage: freshness, nutritional value, and quality of ingredients. Soil quality? Well, not so much. But it turns out this just may be the most important piece of the puzzle, and many of us have been ignoring it completely. It's time to think about where and how our food is grown, for the sake of our well-being and the planet. In recent years, soil quality has severely declined, with soil erosion in parts of the Midwest estimated at up to 46% due to current ways of farming. Regenerative agriculture, on the other hand, increases the quality of soil and therefore boosts the healthiness of our food. When researchers compared crops grown using regenerative organic culture methods with the same crops grown on neighboring farms using conventional methods, they found that soil health does in fact influence nutrient density. Farms following more soil-friendly practices produce crops with better nutritional profiles than their standard counterparts, containing on average more vitamin K, vitamin E, carotenoids, calcium, and antioxidants. The crops in healthier soil were also lower in sodium and nickel, two elements that should not be consumed in abundance. What is this magical method all about, anyway? Regenerative agriculture incorporates a holistic approach to farming and grazing that prioritizes the health of the land with a focus on restoring soil, reducing tillage, and improving biodiversity. So, instead of pushing the land to its limit, maximizing how much of a crop can be grown during one harvest, these circular systems center on ways the earth can heal itself. Over time, the soil's resources are improved rather than depleted. It regenerates, it's born again. A cornerstone of regenerative farming is keeping roots in the ground all year round. Farmers plant cover crops, such as legumes and buckwheat, between harvests, rotate the types of plants on each plot of land, and incorporate intercropping practices, growing a few different types of crops side by side. Many welcome animals into the equation as well. The animal is its own system, says Liz Riffle, owner and operator of Riffle Farms, a holistically managed bison farm based in West Virginia. It clips the grass by eating, it's fertilizing the grass with its manure, and with its hooves, it's actually working the manure into the soil. All of these elements contribute harmoniously toward the same goal, creating a healthier, more nutrient-dense soil. Spend a few minutes at Whole Foods and you'll find dozens of products that claim to be regenerative, from beans and lentils to meat, eggs and dairy, even ice cream. Thousands of products have received some sort of regenerative certification over the past 5 years, and many brands are launching regenerative versions of familiar faves. King Arthur now sells a climate blend flour featuring an assortment of wheat varieties grown on small farms in Montana and North Dakota. Applegate introduced Do Good Dog, an uncured beef hot dog made via holistic grazing methods. And major food companies such as General Mills and Danone have announced plans to incorporate these eco-friendly practices into production systems. But the truth is, regenerative agriculture is nothing new. Its signature practices are based on indigenous wisdom. Regenerative organic agriculture wouldn't exist without indigenous agriculture, says Sorella Harada, co-founder of Simply, a company that connects small farms and single-origin ingredients to consumers. The indigenous agriculture is rooted in respect for the land, and if you go back into communities that have been growing these crops for thousands of years, you'll see it's not only what you get out of the land, but also what you provide and put back into it. It's looking at the full cycle of life. Today, the United States relies on industrial agriculture, a large-scale system that prioritizes output, literally producing as much food as possible. While considered the status quo, it is called conventional farming after all. That hasn't always been the case. It's assumed to be a way of the world, but it's actually more of an aberration in history, says Dan Miller, founder and CEO of Steward. Once upon a time, there were tons of diversified farms, each producing a variety of crops and animals on the same plot of land. During the 20th century, however, farmers switched gears and started monocropping, using the land to grow just one type of crop, like corn or wheat. Next came the introduction of chemical pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, and antibiotics, partly because farmers now needed these tools to suppress weeds and pests. We figured out how to produce a lot for the masses and then brought that mindset over to our food systems, says Riffle. However, it turns out that this method of farming depletes the soil of its nutrients. Planting the same crop year after year is extremely detrimental to soil health. Up to 40% of all lands worldwide are classified as moderately degraded or worse, according to the United Nations report. Soil at its best is very much alive. Dirt is basically the dead version of it. It's full of living microorganisms that circulate nutrients and minerals between plants, and it thrives when a diverse range of crops are involved. Your body wouldn't function properly if you only consumed one food for the rest of your life, right? The same goes for soil. Introduce a range of micro and macronutrients via intercropping, cover crops, and holistic grazing, and the ground becomes healthy. With intercropping, you plant two or more crops together throughout the year, thereby creating more opportunities for soil productivity. Cover crops, such as buckwheat or alfalfa, for their part, keep soil enriched with nutrients and offer other benefits like protection against erosion, weeds, and inclement weather. There's the virtuous cycle that's happening constantly as the plant roots feed the soil microbiome. The soil microbiome feeds the plants, and then the plant above the earth is growing stronger and stronger, says Elizabeth Whitlow, Executive Director of Regenerative Organic Alliance. When you add animals into the mix, you're incorporating aeration and natural fertilizers as well. Atmospheric carbon is sequestered in soil, making the Earth a power player in the fight against global warming. One real-life example, conventional farms in the Chesapeake Bay area reduced their net greenhouse gas emissions by about 50% after adopting regenerative practices like rotational grazing per case studies. Conventional practices like plowing and tilling actually release carbon dioxide. This environmentally friendly way of farming also results in crops that are better adapted to deal with challenges such as droughts and floods. If you're fighting Mother Nature, you're constantly going to have to put a little more fertilizer or a little more herbicide, a little bit more chemicals to be able to control those inputs, says Harada. But if you partner on creating an ecosystem, then you don't have to fight it. Soil and trees and birds and bees can be part of the team to grow an amazing crop. What's more, during bouts of extreme weather, organic farming practices perform up to 40% better compared with conventional methods in the Rodale Institute's Farming Systems Trial, a 40-year research experiment. It's really just a more resilient way of farming, says Miller, as people realize that this type of agriculture can be more beneficial and not require as much support. It will become the dominant form, but that's going to take decades. So if you're now convinced that regenerative is the way to go, you can act on your convictions in different ways. Most of us get to choose what we eat 3 times a day, and what we decide to eat matters. It matters to your health, it matters to your community, and it matters in the long term, says Whitlow. Opt for foods made via regenerative agriculture methods. If you shop at farmers markets, take time to get to know the farmers. You can ask them the straight questions like, where do your animals eat? And what type of grasses are they on? Says Riffle. You may also be able to connect with farmers online. Some offer local or national shipping. Even when you're picking up groceries at the supermarket, you can and should stay curious. Check for regenerative certifications on packaged goods. Pull out your phone and do a quick Google to confirm the company values and whether packaging claims hold up before adding items to your cart. By saying yes to regenerative more often, you can feel you're doing both yourself and the world a favor. You don't need to be a venture capitalist in order to get into the game. Check out Steward, a private investment platform connecting investors with regenerative products that need funding. You can put your dollars towards a good cause and make money in the process. So look for these labels on the package. Regenerative Organic Certified. What it means. Starting with USDA organic guidelines as the minimum baseline, farmers must also keep soil covered, minimize soil disturbance, incorporate diversity, and abide by worker and animal welfare standards, such as paying living wages to staff. Find it in Lil Buck's Sprouted Buckwheat, Simply Beans and Quinoa, and Lundberg Family Farms Rice. The next label is Certified Regenified. What does this mean? Well, farmers must show they're adhering to regenerative practices, integrating livestock, wisely selecting crops, etc., and pass soil assessments. You can find it in Vital Farms Restorative Eggs, Maker's Mark Whiskey, and King Arthur Climate Blend Flour. The next label, Land to Market Verified. So what does that mean? There are measurable indicators that the land is improving in terms of ground cover, water infiltration, and soil carbon levels, confirmed through a science-backed ecological outcome verification method, mainly for animal products, for example, meat, dairy, and leather. You can find it in REP Provisions Meat and Bone Broths, Alexandra Family Farm Milks, Serenity Kids Food Pouches, and Pasture Bird Chicken. All very interesting and exciting to hear about regenerative products. All right, Adventure Eats. Not all snacks are created equal. The best ones will keep you satisfied on any journey from everyday errands to vacation excursions. Spicy Puff. Sorghum, an ancient grain, is used to create the base of these gluten-free snacks that have more staying power than your average puff. Plus, the umami-rich taste, thanks to seaweed, paprika, and a hint of chili, is seriously craveable. They are called Sea Monsters, sweet chili-baked seafood seaweed puffs. Next, Pickle Power. Slices of pickled cukes are packed with a killer combo of potassium and sodium, key electrolytes that help you remain hydrated. The crisp chips boast a classic dill flavor, tops for a salty tang. They are called Sucker Punch Classic Kosher Dill Pickle Pack. Next, Crunch Crush. Are you a granola fan? I know I am. These poppable pumpkin and sunflower seed clusters have the ultimate balance of salt and sugar and offer muscle-supporting magnesium. They are called Go Raw Organic Sprouted Sweet and Salty Clusters. Next, Mighty Minis. The jerky sticks serve up energy-enhancing iron and 4 grams of protein that'll keep you revved all day. Good things come in small, spicy packages. These are called Chomps Jalapeno Beef Chomplings. And finally, Fruit Loop. No added cane sugar here. Instead, the chewy bites are sweetened with freeze-dried berries, coconut, and sunflower seed butter. They deliver filling fiber, and they are called Froze, F-R-O-O-Z-E, Froze Balls Strawberry Fruit Ball Snack. All right, who doesn't love a good snack? I know I do. Next in food, Dinner Delight. A hefty sprinkle of the smoky sweet Middle Eastern spice blend works wonders on a plain old chicken breast. We have a recipe now for shawarma spiced chicken with cucumber salad. It takes 30 minutes and it serves 4. Here's what you'll need. 1/2 cup plus 3/4 cup Greek yogurt divided, 2 tablespoons fresh lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of shawarma seasoning, 1 large clove of garlic with grated kosher salt, 4 6-ounce boneless, skinless chicken breasts, 1 tablespoon olive oil plus more for drizzling, 2 Persian cucumbers thinly sliced, 4 scallions thinly sliced, 1 jalapeno thinly sliced, and 1 cup cilantro leaves. All right, so in a medium bowl, combine 1/2 cup of Greek yogurt with lemon juice, then shawarma seasoning, garlic, and 1/2 teaspoon salt. Add chicken and coat thoroughly. Let marinate for 5 minutes. Next, remove chicken from your marinade, pat dry, and season with 1/4 teaspoon of salt. Heat oil in a large cast iron skillet on medium and cook the chicken, adjusting heat as needed to prevent burning, until deep golden brown and cooked through, about 6 to 7 minutes per side. Transfer to a cutting board and let rest at least 3 minutes before slicing. Meanwhile, in another bowl, toss together cucumbers, scallions, jalapeno, and then cilantro. Divide the remaining 3/4 cup yogurt among plates. Top with your sliced chicken and your salad, and drizzle with additional olive oil. Next on to health. The heart attack all women should know about. It mostly strikes the young and healthy, and doctors are searching for answers. You're so young to have that scar. That's what Naisha Parks often hears when people see the mark on her chest from the open heart surgery she had at age 35. On hot summer days in her hometown of Evans, Georgia, the raised scar peeks out from tank tops. "You had a heart attack?" they ask in disbelief. In 2008, several days after the birth of her son, the former school administrator was hanging out with a friend when she started feeling off. She was exhausted and sweating, and she felt pressure in her chest. Parks told her friends to call 911. Then she blacked out and woke up 3 days later in the hospital. "The way my surgeon describes it, it was like I got run over by a car, hit by a train, and got back up only to be hit by a Mack truck," says Parks. She had suffered a spontaneous coronary artery dissection, or SCAD, that resulted in a heart attack, and then she had a pulmonary embolism. After 28 minutes, the doctors were able to resuscitate her. "This wasn't supposed to happen to me," she says. The doctors could explain the pulmonary embolism, an arterial blockage that was likely the result of her C-section, but they had no answers for the SCAD and ensuing heart attack. At that point in her life, Parks had no negative heart health history and had never been on any long-term medication. Today, Parks takes 20 medications a day. She isn't the first healthy young mom to have a terrifying heart attack appear out of nowhere after a SCAD, which occurs when one of the arteries supplying blood to the heart tears and becomes blocked, resulting in a heart attack. In the general U.S. population, SCAD accounts for around 1 to 4% of acute heart problems every year. But among young women, it's one of the most common causes of heart attack, says Esther Kim, director of the Center for Women's Cardiovascular Health at Atrium Health Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute. SCAD's true prevalence isn't fully known, and the survival rate is also undetermined, because the condition is often misdiagnosed and underreported. What experts do know is that up to 35% of heart attacks in women under 50 can be attributed to SCAD, and that 9 out of 10 SCAD patients are female. The first SCAD report was recorded almost 95 years ago. On November 12, 1930, Harold C. Pretty, MD, was summoned to the home of a 42-year-old married mother of four who had been vomiting all night. The family, who lived in England, had eaten a meal of fish and chips, so Dr. Pretty prescribed her some remedies, think castor oil, for an upset stomach. The next night, after experiencing chest pain and more nausea, the woman, unnamed in medical records, died in her husband's arms. In a post-mortem exam, Dr. Pretty realized that her gut wasn't the issue. She suffered an aortic dissection. His discovery was rare enough that the case was submitted for publication, and her story appeared in the British Medical Journal the following year. Until relatively recently, most doctors still weren't familiar with SCAD. Women were often misdiagnosed, or the heart condition was treated incorrectly. Patients were told that having a heart attack at such a young age was rare, like being struck by lightning. If they survived, they were sent home, told they were lucky to be alive, and prescribed medication and rehab. In 2015, Kira Alston, who is now a two-time SCAD survivor, was just 33 years old when she walked into her local ER in Northern Virginia. She had to push the doctors to take her pain seriously. "While I was lying in a hospital bed, they kept telling me, 'We can't find anything wrong with you.'" Alston, now 41, says, noting that her EKG came back normal. "But I kept having to sit up and throw up into a blanket. I'm sorry, a bucket. A bucket. Something was wrong." It took nearly 2 hours for doctors to run blood work, which eventually revealed levels of troponin, a protein released in the blood during a heart attack, showing she was in cardiac arrest. Doctors later attributed it to SCAD. In 2007, Rebecca Freeman, now 38, went to the ER as a University of South Carolina junior, complaining of chest pains and shortness of breath. The doctors opted not to check her heart and instead did a drug screen on her twice. Both tests came back negative. Finally, they performed an EKG and a troponin test, which showed that her protein level was sky high. In 2003, Catherine Leon had to make two trips to the emergency room days apart before being admitted for breathing difficulties, as well as chest and upper back pain and arm numbness. On the first visit, she was told to get her gallbladder and her childhood asthma checked out. After she went back to the hospital a second time and spent 2 days under surveillance, doctors realized the 38-year-old mom of two would need emergency double bypass surgery. Those doctors were able to save her life, but they had no explanations about why her SCAD occurred. "I could have just died." They were like, "Don't worry about it. Just don't have another baby," says Leon. At that time, docs thought childbirth was a trigger, but experts now know that less than 10% of SCADs occurs post-delivery. Leon was crushed. She wanted to have more kids and was worried about the one she had. I asked if my children might have this illness, and the doctor said, "Well, they're boys, they're not going to get pregnant." And I remember thinking, that doesn't make any sense at all. SCAD research exists today thanks to a strong partnership between patients and doctors. After her heart attack, Leon sought out other SCAD survivors online. She eventually started a message board for that small group on the Women Heart website, a women's heart disease community. Leon's group began with 3 women, but grew to more than 70 women by 2009. Leon decided to approach Sharon Hayes, a doctor and a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic. At the annual Women Heart Science and Leadership Symposium taking place that year at the clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, she asked Dr. Hayes to research SCAD. At the time, the largest SCAD study had only 43 patients, and Leon's group was almost twice that size. Dr. Hayes agreed to help. Leon and Dr. Hayes' collaboration eventually led to a pilot study, a virtual SCAD registry, and various publications that form the foundation of SCAD knowledge and research in the U.S. today. In 2018, SCAD received more of worldwide attention that it needed badly. That year, researchers led by Dr. Hayes as well as Dr. Kim published an article on SCAD in the American Heart Association's journal. "I did not set out to change research. I set out to advocate for a group of patients who came forward with a condition for which there was little known," says Dr. Hayes. Leon kept pushing ahead. In 2013, she and a friend from the message board, Rachel Doquette, co-founded the SCAD Alliance, an organization that focuses on education, awareness, support, and research. By 2019, Dr. Kim had helped create the iSCAD registry, funded by the SCAD Alliance, which collects data from SCAD patients across the globe. Boy, both iSCAD and the Mayo Clinic's registries have more than 1,500 participants. Other networks have popped up along the way to raise awareness and fund research, like SCAD Research Incorporated, founded in 2011. Well, my friends, we've reached the end of our time together. Hope you enjoyed this issue of Women's Health Magazine. Again, my name is Susie Bartlett, wishing you the best day ever. Make it a good one. Bye-bye.